The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
These platforms may have warped the underlying physics of speech to such an extent that our ordinary assumptions about the marketplace of ideas, the freedom of speech, just no longer work. And I suspect that over the very long run, the societies that really make it and manage to preserve a system of robust free speech will be societies that somehow figure out a way to restructure or even eradicate these platforms as we know them today, you know, ad-driven social platforms. Now, with that being said, you know, if we're going to assume that we're going to continue to live with Facebook, Twitter, you know, these ad-driven platforms that rely on viral speech, then I think it's still worth our while to figure out how much of the First Amendment we can salvage and apply as a kind of rule of law.
I'm Alan Rosenstein, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 8th, 2020. Yesterday, Lawfare released the first paper in its Digital Social Contract paper series. For each paper, I'll be doing a podcast interview with the author. And today, my guest is law professor Kyle Langvart of the University of Nebraska College of Law. His paper, Platform Speech Governance and the First Amendment, a User-Centered Approach, examines how the First Amendment should and shouldn't apply to the content moderation decisions of major internet platforms. But first, a brief conversation with Lawfare Editor-in-Chief Ben Wittes, where we discuss the paper series as a whole. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 8th, the first digital social contract paper series interview, Kyle Langvart on Platform Speech and the First Amendment.
So, Alan, before we get started with the first episode of this series, let's talk a little bit about the larger project here. What is the Digital Social Contract paper series?
The goal of this paper series is to do what Lawfare's always done, which is to analyze the really interesting questions at the intersection of law and public policy and national security and technology, but to do it in a larger scope and in a longer form. And in particular, the reason we're calling it the digital social contract is because generally when we think of public policy, we think of the two most important actors being the people on the one hand and then the government on the other, right? And that is traditionally what we think of as the social contract. The people come together to create this government that implements its preferences for them. But when it comes increasingly to issues of technology and technological advancement, there's another entity that is also really important and plays almost an independent third role. And that is large technology companies, and one can say the sort of technology industry as a whole. And so we thought it'd be really interesting to think through some emerging policy issues and legal issues through this lens of, on the one hand, you have the people, on the other hand, you have the government, and sort of on the third hand, you have these technology companies and the technology industry and researchers and academics and nonprofits, all of whom play an increasingly important role. And that's what we're going to focus on with this paper series.
So what are the range of topics that this is going to cover? I mean, you know, the themes that you're describing here potentially cover a huge range of ground On the other hand, they exclude some things that Lawfare has historically been interested. So how do you understand the scope of the paper series?
For me, I prefer to understand it as broadly as possible, just because I think it's more fun that way. I want to spread the scope as much as possible. So maybe the best way is just to describe what the initial set of papers is going to be about. Our first paper is about technology companies and their First Amendment rights or lack thereof. Another paper is about cryptocurrencies and the effect that that's going to have on money laundering. The following paper is about COVID apps and why they have not been particularly successful so far and how they can be made more successful in the future. We're going to have more papers after this discussing a wide range of additional topics. But the goal was to cast our net pretty broadly, in part because technology is becoming more and more central across a wide variety of different policy areas.
Finally, readers of this initial paper will notice a disclosure concerning Facebook. What is the relationship between this paper series and Facebook?
So the paper series is supported with funding from Facebook, and we appreciate that, obviously, very much. But we were very careful in setting up this series to make sure that Facebook did not have any editorial role in picking the authors or in picking the topics or in reviewing any of the work. So Facebook is a funder, but again, it plays no substantive role, and that's also very much what Facebook wanted.
And so, to the extent that readers are inclined to dismiss this paper series as a Facebook sponsored thing, what is your advice to them?
You know, obviously they can do so if they want, but I would urge them to keep an open mind. And I think that they will see as they read these papers that there's a really broad variety of views and that the funding source is completely independent from the positions taken by these authors.
And with that, let's go on with the first discussion.
It makes intuitive sense that when individuals speak online, they're exercising their First Amendment rights. But as you point out, large platforms have also been making arguments about what constitutes their own speech. And in particular, they've argued that their content moderation decisions are a kind of speech that should be protected by the First Amendment. Now, you argue, I think, very convincingly in your paper against this. But before we get into your argument, can you just explain what the argument is for the tech platform's position and where it comes from?
Yeah, well, so the argument that the platforms make is that when they decide whether either to host content or to take content down, they're engaging in a kind of editorial decision making that's similar to what a newspaper does. You hear the word curation used a lot. And so there's a classic case called Miami Herald versus Tornillo, where the Supreme Court said that that kind of editorial decision-making counts as a form of speech in itself. And the government can't step in to regulate that kind of editorial decision-making, even if we can show, as in the case of a newspaper, that the editor may have a kind of bottleneck position in the market. So, you know, the old newspapers tended to have kind of a monopolistic market position within their geographical region. The court said that kind of monopoly power just isn't good enough to authorize the state to step in. So you can see why this argument would be pretty attractive to the tech platforms. You know, they're also in a kind of quasi-monopolistic bottleneck kind of position. But they would say, hey, look, we're exercising editorial discretion, and the fact that we're heavy hitters just is not a good enough reason for the government to override that.
And is this an argument that they've been making and winning on, or is this just an argument that has been circulating?
Well, it's an argument that's been out there for a while for search platforms. And search platforms have won on this argument, at least in lower courts. The Supreme Court hasn't decided this. There are also some lower court cases that kind of comment on this argument in the context of content moderation on social media. Now, this is litigation where, for example, you have a social media user who is claiming that the platform is like a public forum that's subject to First Amendment limitations. You know, not real well represented, not real well argued. But courts have said things kind of offhandedly to the effect that, you know, the platforms really have their own First Amendment rights here to speak.
And so what would the practical effect of recognizing the First Amendment rights of platforms be? So I'm thinking there are rules, you know, in particular in the intellectual property and the copyright context, where platforms have to take down copyrighted material that's been shared illegally. And I don't get the sense that they'd be able to respond to that by saying, but we have a First Amendment right to carry pirated movies and music. So in what way does the First Amendment argument disable the sorts of content moderation that you would want the government to consider being able to do?
Well, so, I mean, first of all, you kind of have to take the copyright context and set it aside a little bit. So, you know, a newspaper wouldn't have the right to carry third-party copyrighted content under the First Amendment. And on top of that, we have laws like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that impose certain burdens on the platform to actually go and take down copyrighted content once it's been flagged. Now, the court's generally more tolerant of that kind of heavy-handed intervention if we're talking about copyright. Copyright concerns are treated as kind of outside the ordinary run of First Amendment litigation. But let's say that we had a type of law that required platforms to handle other kinds of content differently. So if you had a law like NetzDG in Germany, for example, a bad law in all kinds of ways, but a law that required platforms to identify and take down content that was manifestly illegal. Or say that you had a law that required platforms to leave certain types of speech up, you know, not to discriminate against certain viewpoints or whatever. I think in either case, the platform would say you're interfering with our editorial discretion. And what that means is you are changing the content of our speech. Now, in First Amendment law, if the law tries to change or regulate the content of a person's speech, then we apply this standard called strict scrutiny, which, you know, I'm sure lots of listeners here are familiar with. But the government has to have a compelling governmental purpose to regulate, and its means have to be narrowly tailored to accomplishing that purpose. So basically, any time that the government tried to step in and set rules for what we call content moderation, we would apply this strict scrutiny standard, no matter what kind of governmental interference we're looking at.
And that would presumably just make it much, much harder then for the government to be able to do that. So, you know, even if the government could occasionally win under this standard, it would just be a huge impediment to the sorts of active legislation and regulation that we tend to think about when we think of government action. Is that the idea?
Yeah, it's a really hard standard to pass. And I think what's important to consider here is it's the standard that would apply if the government wanted the platform to take more stuff down. But it's also the standard that would apply if the government wanted platforms to observe some kind of free speech principle, you know, to protect the speech rights of users. We'd be applying the same strict scrutiny standard either way, which I think is pretty problematic.
So let's talk about that. So we've made the affirmative case for, or we've at least described the case for why tech companies have this First Amendment editorial right to control what's on their platforms. You argue that they shouldn't have this right, or that the First Amendment doesn't give them this right. And so I was hoping you could explain that. Is it a legal objection? Is it a policy objection? What's going on there?
Well, it's kind of both, which is usually the case when we talk about constitutional law. You know, when people talk about the First Amendment rights of platforms or the rights that platforms might not have, people tend to get into this trap of asking whether the platform is more like a newspaper or whether it's more like, let's say, the phone company. You know, is it the kind of entity that controls and edits content on the one hand, or is it the kind of entity that just lets it all pass through the way that the phone company does? And I think the basic trap when you confine yourself to those two analogies is you've already conceded at some level that you're looking at a case that's about speech. I would say that when a platform polices content in order to protect public safety, that, you know, it's maybe more like a mall cop. It doesn't mean that the platform's doing something bad or suspicious in First Amendment terms. But I think it's just kind of orthogonal to the First Amendment. It's regulating speech. It's not actually speaking.
Let's talk more about this. So, you know, in your paper, you talk a lot about how it's important to have a user-centric rather than a platform-centric conception of a First Amendment. Mm-hmm. I was hoping you could explain what you mean by that contrast.
Yeah, well, so here's the thing. Even if platforms have their own First Amendment rights, it also goes without saying that users on the platforms have their own First Amendment rights. Now, that doesn't mean that if I'm a Facebook user, I can sue Facebook and Facebook has to follow the First Amendment. It doesn't mean that at all. Facebook is not a state actor. But it does mean that if the government were to step in and act as a kind of puppeteer, controlling Facebook's censorship policies, and if then I was the victim there, you know, if Facebook took my speech down in order to follow the law, well, my First Amendment rights would be implicated there, and I would have a First Amendment right against that governmental regulation. So no matter what, user speech rights are already in play. Now, my view is that if we're going to try to figure out when the government can and can't regulate a platform's content moderation policies, all we really need to do is just ask about the effects downstream on that user speech. Saying that the platform has its own First Amendment right, that doesn't add anything to the analysis at all, in my view.
What about the argument that you hear sometimes that, well, these platforms are technological entities and their platforms are run using complex computer systems, and those computer systems reflect some expressive choices that the programmers have made? This is the so-called code is speech argument that started in the 90s and is occasionally cited. You know, is that something that tech companies should be able to use as a shield against regulation?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty skeptical of these arguments. Now, on the one hand, you know, you can say that, yeah, the platform is maybe expressing certain values that it has if it sets a policy that it's going to take down terrorist content. You know, it thinks terrorism is bad. You can also say that the platform is handling speech, and maybe that makes it feel a little bit like the platform is speaking indirectly. But the basic problem with that argument is you could say the same thing anytime anybody regulates or censors speech. So when the government adopts a law that would censor speech, for example, say you can't engage in incitement, you know, we could say that the government is engaged in some kind of a messaging project. I mean, the government is saying that incitement is bad. The government is also handling speech in much the same way that a platform handles speech. But, you know, the really salient aspect of what the government is doing there is regulatory, not expressive. And we regard it as a form of speech regulation, not just the government communicating its message. So I would say the same thing when a platform regulates speech. Sure, at some conceptual level, maybe the platform is communicating something, but that's not the relevant level of analysis. You know, let's say that Google decides to open its new headquarters in Detroit, where I used to live. That's also a choice. It involves some degree of human decision making, and it expresses certain corporate values. You know, they want to express their support for the business culture there in Detroit. But people recognize at a kind of common sense level that the First Amendment just can't possibly give us a sane framework for regulating those kinds of business decisions. That's the way I would look at this.
And so if I understand, then presumably the same would be true if the company argues that because it's acting through computer code and computer code can be used for expressive purposes, that doesn't simply by itself turn every computer into a core site of First Amendment speech.
Yeah, I think the computer code argument is even more specious than the editorial argument. The basis for the computer code argument, going back to the original case law in the 1990s, was that computer code or at least source code, is a kind of language. And so therefore, anything expressed in computer code, or at least source code, is a form of speech. Well, that's not the way that we treat actual language. I mean, there are all kinds of things we do with languages like English that we don't regard as speech that implicates the First Amendment. If you and I make a contract, for example. So the notion that anything that is expressed in any kind of language counts as speech, I think, leads to just kind of ludicrous outcomes. And actually, if you look at the case law that would apply this standard, you can see that the courts really have bent over backwards to water down the kind of analysis that they apply to these computer code as speech claims.
Do you think there's any context in which what technology companies do on their platforms is speech, is their own legitimate First Amendment speech, or are they all, should we always and in all circumstances think of them analogous to your phone company, right? Which mm-hmm. obviously hosts your speech, but itself is never really speaking.
Yeah, I think there's definitely situations where the platform speaks. So if a platform puts out a press release, that's speech. The Google Doodle, I mean, that's a form of speech. I would be willing to say that if Twitter tags a Trump tweet, that's speech. I mean, I could see somebody making an argument that maybe we should look at that as more regulatory, but I think that basically looks like speech. Facebook has the banner on the top during the elections that says the votes are still being counted. That's speech. It's like something a TV network would do. But I think when we really go off the rails with this, is where a platform isn't putting out something that we would ordinarily recognize as a message, but instead taking down other people's speech. And especially if you have a single platform that is managing the speech of like 2 billion users, you know, like Facebook, that's a point where we could say, look, even if we are kind of sympathetic to the idea that the platform speaks and expresses its values through these censorship policies, that's just an interest that's overbalanced so many times over by these 2 billion other speakers that we should disregard it as kind of trivial.
To me, one of the hardest areas here is what to do about the algorithms that these tech companies use to either promote certain users and certain posts and then sort of demote other users. Because on the one hand, if Twitter or Facebook had a, you know, editor's feature sidebar where they picked out their favorite tweets of the day, and you know, if you can go to the Apple App Store or the Google Store and they'll do editor's choice apps of the day, that strikes me as, again, quintessentially First Amendment speech of the platforms themselves. Absolutely. And then if you accept that, then maybe you can argue that, well, then what they do algorithmically is just an extension of that. They've just trained a bunch of their computers to replicate their judgment, and they can then deploy that to scale across their billions of users. But now we get into the problem you just ran into, which is now we seem to be heavily overweighting whatever speech interests platforms have. So is it just a matter of, in the law, we have to draw some arbitrary boundaries sometimes, and maybe the line between individual versus algorithmic decision making is that line, you know, even if it's not conceptually perfect, it's the most workable line that we can draw in the law?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it's important to find some kind of a workable line. And, you know, I'm not sure that I would draw the line at algorithmic speech. I can imagine some contexts where an algorithm could be used to produce art. I mean, that kind of thing has taken place. Or let's say most sports pages today on the internet, my understanding is that they produce a lot of algorithmically generated content. You know, I'm fine with that counting as speech, I think. But I think what's really important is not to mistake regulation for a form of speech. And these platforms, whether we want to compare them to states or not, I think are clearly involved in regulation or governance of speech. If we're going to recognize that kind of activity as speech, then whatever the theoretical merits of the argument, we have in practice set up a kind of a separation of powers where a few private companies are permitted to regulate speech in a way that the government would never, ever be able to. That, I think, is what we have to avoid.
So let's say we've drawn the line somewhere. We've identified some stuff that is speech. We've identified a bunch of stuff that isn't speech. And in particular, we've said that, okay, a bunch of what platforms do when they are regulating what users can and cannot say is not going to count as their own, which is to say the platform's own First Amendment speech. Mm-hmm. That then creates a space for government regulation. And there are three types that you talk about. So I'm going to describe them, and then I'd like to talk about each one of them in turn a little bit. So the first type of government regulation is requirements that platforms take certain content down. The second type is rules about how the platforms themselves are designed. And then the third is kind of the flip side, which is rules that limit what platforms can remove from their own sites. So limits on platform censorship. So let's talk about each of these in turn. So on the first proposal, or the first kind of regulation, the takedown mandates, what are the sorts of things that the government might want internet platforms to remove? And what First Amendment issues does that raise, either, again, for the platforms themselves or in the absence of any platform rights for users?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first things that government might set out to have removed would be in the bucket of incitement to lawless action or misinformation that could lead to, you know, real world physical harm. So false claims about coronavirus, I think, fall into this kind of bucket, but also conceivably certain kinds of, for example, hate speech, you know, the kind of stuff that led to, that went viral and led to ethnic cleansing and in Myanmar. You know, these are the kinds of circumstances where I could see the government claiming some kind of interest in stepping in and making sure this stuff doesn't go viral and cause horrible real world consequences. Now, traditionally, the government has not had very much room to regulate this kind of harm-causing speech at all. There's a standard called the Brandenburg standard. It's just extremely demanding. I mean, the government can really only step in cases where a person has used explicit language exhorting somebody to violate the law, and where it's likely to happen, and where it's imminent that it's going to happen. That seems like a very, very restrictive standard, I think, for the social media environment. And the government would probably try to go beyond that. But I think that's the first kind of content that the government would try to force platforms to take down, content that would lead to real-world harm in the short term.
And under your system, I mean, would there be any First Amendment limits to this? I mean, you know, what we've gotten to in this conversation is that technology companies should not be able to claim the First Amendment themselves. So who is going to defend us against government censorship under a regime like this?
Well, so this is, I think, kind of an unsettling question to think about. And I can maybe back up and give a little bit of broader perspective here. My overall view is that these platforms may have warped the underlying physics of speech to such an extent that our ordinary assumptions about the marketplace of ideas, the freedom of speech, just no longer work. You know, this is a really kind of dark place. And I suspect that over the very long run, the societies that really make it and manage to preserve a system of robust free speech will be societies that somehow figure out a way to restructure or even eradicate these platforms as we know them today, you know, ad-driven social platforms. Now, with that being said, you know, if we're going to assume that we're going to continue to live with Facebook, Twitter, you know, these ad-driven platforms that rely on on viral speech, then I think it's still worth our while to figure out how much of the First Amendment we can salvage and apply as a kind of rule of law. And so if we're going to talk about the way that the First Amendment would apply to these takedowns, what we have to do is look at certain types of First Amendment doctrines that appear almost impossibly strict and figure out if there's a way that we can kind of water them down responsibly to make them workable. I think that the first major roadblock that we run into is the prior restraint doctrine. You know, traditionally there is a heavy presumption against the government stepping in and requiring that speech be censored or removed, preventing people from speaking. Well, let's say that the government does want platforms to go in and identify certain types of unlawful or dangerous content and take them down. That's a dangerous place to be, because if the government has put financial incentives, say liability incentives, on the platform to remove this stuff, then the platforms are going to tend to over-censor. This is a dynamic that, that Jack Balkin has called collateral censorship. What we have to do is figure out a way to create some room for government to do this while still retaining some protections. And so I think that the first place that I would look here, if the government wanted a platform to take stuff down, is what are called the Manila principles. And the Manila principles are kind of like a civil society document that encourage governments, among other things, to obtain a court order before certain types of content are going to be taken down. You know, principles that the platforms not go and determine whether the content itself is illegal and then step in. So I might try to borrow from some of these ideas from civil society. The next area where I think that you run into a problem is this doctrine about incitement and the government's limited ability to step in and penalize speech because it's dangerous or because it's likely to lead to real-world harm. This can get pretty complex, but I think we have to wind up with a standard that's quite a bit more flexible than the Brandenburg standard I discussed earlier. I don't know how much detail you want me to get into here, but I think it's possible that we wind up with a standard that looks a lot more like the old clear and present danger standard from the early days of the First Amendment, one where there was just really a lot more flexibility for the government to penalize speech that might not lead to absolutely imminent harm, speech that might not have been intended to lead to harm, you know, that kind of thing. So that we'd have a really watered down set of rules, but it would at least be some set of rules, which I think is better than what we have today.
And your paper goes into more detail on the content of those rules. So I'll refer listeners to that. One thing I did want to clarify, though, was under the framework that you propose, it's not as if users wouldn't still be able to argue against government takedown orders on the basis of their own First Amendment rights. So this strikes me as an important point, right?
All you're doing
is getting rid of the ability of technology companies to say that they have a First Amendment right against being told by the government to take something down. But users, you and me, would still presumably be able to walk into court and say, when the government told Facebook to take down all quote-unquote terrorist content, that had an impact on my speech and that violated my First Amendment rights. Just to make sure we're on the same page on that.
Oh, absolutely. And this is the most important point. If the government were to commandeer a platform, require the platform to take down my, let's say, terrorist speech, then I would have a right to challenge the government there. That would be my right. The platform would not have its own separate right to say that its rights had been challenged. But conceivably, the platform might be able to kind of piggyback off of my rights or join the litigation. But it would be my rights that would really be central here, not the platforms.
So I'm going to pass over the issue of platform design restrictions, though, again, your paper does a great job of talking about them. I'm going to ask us to turn briefly to the third kind of government regulation, which is the opposite, in a sense, of a takedown requirement. And that's a mandate to keep user content on the platforms. So a lot of this has come, at least recently, from conservatives who believe, not, I think, without some justification, but also in a quite exaggerated way, that Silicon Valley companies are, by their nature, not the most friendly to conservatives, at least in terms of the internal politics of Silicon Valley employees. Now, I'm not personally convinced that Facebook and Twitter really are disproportionately censoring conservative views. There might be an exception here for the views of the president, though that's in part because he's so exceptional in lying so often on social media. And again, other ways, social media has been really helpful to, in particular, far right views and far left views. But let's assume that there is some degree of unfriendliness towards the right. Let's say, assume that there is some disproportionate censorship. I guess my first question is, before we get into what sorts of government policies might cure this problem, do we really even need government policies at all? Is legal intervention necessary? And I ask because lately we've seen the rise of conservative platforms like Parler, which is kind of a replacement for Twitter, or Rumble, which is, again, a replacement for YouTube. And basically what these companies do is they copy a standard social network and they just impose fewer moderation on it, right? Mm-hmm. They allow for more misinformation, or they have different content standards, or you know, whatever the case is. And I'm sure that one could, and that the market would create similar kinds of alternatives for far left speech if the far left started worrying about censorship. So given how relatively easy it is to start your own social networking platform, the technology is not that complicated. Servers are actually pretty cheap to rent. Why not just let the market deal with this issue of ensuring that all users have some venue to express their opinion online? The internet is, after all, kind of infinite. And so do we even really need government intervention to prevent platform censorship?
Yeah, well, so first of all, I share your skepticism about the claims that conservatives have been disproportionately censored. Now, that being said, I think I can empathize with conservatives' concerns here. And I think, you know, someone who's not a Republican, I would be pretty freaked out if, let's say, Walmart, or more to the point, the Mercers, owned the dominant social platform. And I think I would be freaked out even in the absence of specific evidence that there was viewpoint-based censorship going on already. The danger just seems too severe, especially given what we know about platforms' abilities to manipulate electoral turnout and that kind of thing. Now, as for the role that markets might play, you know, I'm very skeptical that market forces have a helpful role to play here. Now, I guess the first thing that I would point to is the role of network effects in entrenching the power of a platform like Facebook or Twitter. It's not clear to me that these platforms are really going to be subject to meaningful market pressures from the outside. Now, I may be wrong about that, but I think there's at least some room to be skeptical. Now, I guess if there are market pressures, what kinds of market pressures are we going to look at? And I'll get to the Parler point here. The first market pressures we should look at are really market pressures that come from the ad companies, because Facebook, Twitter, you know, YouTube, whatever platform with free services we're talking about is really going to be an advertising platform. And my sense is that to the extent they respond to market pressures, the most meaningful market pressures are going to be those that come from the advertisers who pay them. Now, the advertisers may sometimes have some interest in the platform's content moderation policies. But those, their interest in the platform's content moderation policies is mainly going to be an interest in making sure that their own advertising gets carried. They may occasionally have an interest in seeing a platform improve its content moderation policies more as a kind of general policy or societal matter. But when they do, I expect that it will tend more in the direction of taking more speech down. Now, as for Parler, you know, is Parler a kind of case study that might indicate how the market might call for a freer system of content governance? My sense on this is no. Now, first of all, I would say with Parler or Gab or any of these so-called free speech social media services, they're really small fry. I think Parler right now is at about 10 million users. And, you know, if these platforms really are just kind of leaving everything up and not really moderating much at all, then they're probably not especially enjoyable places to hang out, you know, unless you're from like the extreme right or something like that. As long as that's the case, then these platforms are never going to pose a real threat to a broad-based platform like Facebook or Twitter. Now, let's say, on the other hand, that these platforms are large enough to be a major player and to threaten Facebook or Twitter's dominant position. Well, if that's the case, then I think we've got to start asking some real questions about what these platforms are really up to. Now, Parler says that it's a platform for free speech, unbiased content moderation. But I would not take Parler at its word when it says that. This is a platform that's underwritten by the Mercers. These are the people behind Cambridge Analytica in the 2016 election. And I think there's every reason to suspect that they're engaging in the kind of invidious content moderation practices that they would accuse a platform like Facebook of. If we do have a competition between a lot of different platforms, I think it's unlikely that that's going to be a competition among users to find the platform that has the most optimal or the most liberal free speech policy. I think it's much more likely that we're going to have users competing for content moderation policies that satisfy or mollify their own ideological preferences. And that, you know, will just kind of be sort of a race to the bottom, I think.
So the idea here would be that the reason, or one reason why the government might want to impose some neutrality standards or you know, whatever it is on platforms is to avoid a situation in which you end up with a lot of basically filter bubbles, like a lot of different platforms. You know, you have one targeted to this group and that group, and then no one actually ends up talking across groups.
And I suspect, let's say that we have a bunch of filter bubble platforms that, you know, cater to people at different ends of the ideological spectrum. I think at that point, the policy conversation just kind of moves up a level. We no longer have a single platform that we expect to come in and regulate all this speech. I think people would start demanding that the state come in and regulate all this speech.
Are there any First Amendment issues with the government requiring a certain level of editorial neutrality? I mean, assuming that we've established that tech companies don't have a First Amendment right in their editorial decisions, you know, usually we think of the First Amendment as protecting the government from restricting speech. But here, the government is actually trying to promote speech by restricting the ability of someone else, the platform, to remove the speech. So does the government have a completely free rein in the sorts of neutrality requirements it imposes, or is there some limitation nevertheless there?
So first of all, and I know you already said this, we've got to be very clear that we're talking about a scenario in which the platforms don't have their own speech rights. So if the platform has its own speech right, then we're at strict scrutiny, you know, that very difficult threshold to pass. If the platform isn't its own speaker, though, then the First Amendment consequences of a viewpoint neutrality standard are kind of murky. I mean, this is something that's really pretty unfamiliar. You know, I think at first impression, it might seem that there's no First Amendment problem at all. I mean, if all that the government is doing is requiring a platform to leave a lot more speech in place, then we could say that no one's speech has really been burdened. There's just no one who's in a position to sue or challenge it under the First Amendment. And that's one possibility. Now, I think the thing that we've got to keep in mind is if we're talking about a scenario like this, we're talking about issues that will arise for some time going into the future. And so the way that we think about First Amendment rights is going to change in that time. It could be that a decade from now, a couple decades from now, the courts are more sensitive to the role that, say, trolls can play in inhibiting a person's speech. And who knows? I mean, maybe a speaker on one of these platforms could say that, look, I have been trying to speak, but I'm just trolled and threatened incessantly by these other speakers on the platform. And when the government requires the platform to observe viewpoint neutrality, it therefore requires kind of indirectly inhibiting my speech. I mean, this is not a theory that the courts today would adopt. But over the long term, I think it's a theory that's not obviously unreasonable. And so even something like a viewpoint neutrality standard that today might seem to be totally innocuous in First Amendment terms might, under a different interpretation of the First Amendment, look a little more suspicious.
So there's obviously a lot more to talk about here, but I think this is a good place to end for now. Kyle, thanks so much for speaking with me. This is obviously an immensely complex issue, and yeah. I really appreciate you sharing your insight.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me here, Alan.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you've liked what you've heard, please take a moment to rate the podcast or let someone know so they can enjoy it as well. This podcast is produced by Jen Patya Howell. Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo is our audio engineer. And Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.